History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some stories there that should not go untold. And what we've learned is they don't have to go untold if we'll take a little time to ask some questions, and more importantly, if we'll take the time to listen to what comes back our way. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And along the way, not only are we educated, not only are we entertained, but so often we're inspired by these stories from our greatest generation, and I trust that'll be the case again today in Turlock, California, home for nearly 70 years now to Wayne Bailey, 94 years old, a Navy veteran of World War II. But you did not grow up here in the Central Valley of California, a long way from here. Tell me where your earliest memories were formed, Wayne.
In Spring Valley, Minnesota. Actually, I was born in Chatfield, Minnesota, which is about 15 miles from Spring Valley, but I was born in Chatfield, Minnesota on the farm. We were there until I was 8 years old, and then we moved to Spring Valley, where my father went into the grocery business. We lost the farm.
Yeah, and you're hitting on a few things that are common experiences for a lot of people of your generation. But I'm interested to find out what memories you have of those early years. You say growing up on a farm. Oh. I'm thinking you probably had some chores even at a very young age that most of us don't have.
Oh, yes. One of the ones I hated worse was what they call stripping the cows by hand when they'd gone through and milked the cow, and then the cow has a little milk left in the udder, and you had to get the last milk out because we needed every penny that we could get. That was my job, with a little pail that syrup came in, a little metal pail, and that I'd strip the cows after my dad and older brothers would go through and do the milking, and I'd go behind and, like I said, call stripping the cows, getting about a quart of milk or more that would help make the payments that we had to make.
Yeah, and what a picture. I mean, what a microcosm of what a lot of people were going through during the Great Depression. That sounds like that was a very real feel of that for you.
It was. It really was. There was many things like that we didn't have toys or anything much to play with, so we made our own, and I'm sure a lot of you people would remember that too.
Can you give us an example of that? Was there a favorite toy that you put together yourself?
Sure was. You took a lath and made a T, and a long handle like this with a T, and a little metal wheel, and you'd push that all around the barn area and the house and so forth. That was one of the exciting things. And the other one was throwing a ball over the house, calling Annie over. Ones would catch them on the other side. And then if you caught it, you run around and you tagged one of the girls, of course. That was the big thing. It was to tag a girl, not a boy. But that was another one of them. Then there was, of course, going down in the pastures we had to bring our cattle home. Our kids, we had to go down, my brothers and I, and bring the cattle up from the pasture. And we were always doing crazy things. And we had a long lane that had barbed wire on both sides before we got to the barnyard. And my middle brother, Warren, he was always into mischief. And he says, "I think I can walk this blindfolded." And he did. He walked right into the barbed wire and punctured his eyelids and oof, stuff. And of course, there's no doctors. And my mother had to patch that up and whatnot. And then the next thing he did was pick up a spotted adder snake, which is poisonous, and had that by the tail, and he'd bring that up to the house and was showing it off and how brave he was. And he wasn't too brave after he had the paddling that he got from his dad and whatnot for doing that. And then there was always the slingshots that we had, and on top of the house or barn we had what they call lightning rods, so that the lightning, when it would strike, it would go to the cable, would take it to the ground. And of course they had colorful globes that were attractive. And the first thing, of course, we were told never to use our slingshots and break any globes. Well, we didn't have to wait long until my folks went to town and us kids were home alone, and the first thing we did was break one of those bulbs for my dad, and we never broke another one, believe me.
Is that because of something you felt?
Oh, you bet we did. A leather strap. We learned.
Do you remember at that age having a dream or an ambition, something, hey, when I grow up, here's what I'm going to do with my life?
Not on the farm. I didn't, that I can recall. I did in the service.
And we'll talk about that. But since you mentioned losing the farm, you know, this is something that happened to so many American families in those years.
Yes.
How did that affect you and your family? Did you get a picture of how hard that was for your parents?
Oh, yes, because when my father, after selling everything on the farm was 260 acres, selling everything, he had $1,200, and he had made up his mind that he couldn't make a living farming because everybody was losing their farms, most of them, rather. He went to work in a grocery store in Rochester, which was 25 miles from Chapfield. He worked there for about 6 months when he was told by the manager, and again, at that time, sugar, flour, and that type of commodities were in, flour was in 25 and 50 pound bags, sugar came in 100 pound burlap bags with a type of a canvas bag inside the burlap bag. And he was told one day, the manager told him to go and poke a pencil. Into the bag and drain out 10 pounds. The manager told him, he says, no one will know that there's any sugar out of that. He says, we can sell that as 100 pounds and use the 10 pound on the shelf for profit. My dad said he wouldn't do it. He says, I'll quit before I do that. And he says, well, then you quit. He came home and, of course, no income. Like I said, he left the farm with these $1,200 and went to Spring Valley, and he rented a building. The rent was $50, and he paid the $50. And then he went to the other stores and talked to the owners and managers to see how they handled things. And they told him that he was crazy, that he should never have rented that building. He says, you'll never do it, and you don't know anything about the grocery business. And so he went and put that back and never took the building, let the money go, and went home and told my mother, and she talked him into going back and going through with it. She says, we'll do it some way. He went back and rented a little building and started. That was the first in starting the grocery business. We worked it as a family with no help. He didn't know how to buy groceries or anything. He went to a wholesale house, which was in a nearby town. He told the fellow, he says, I need groceries to fill the store. And he says, I don't know how to put them, arrange them on the shelf. And he says, I don't know what I need, but he says, I'd like to buy my groceries, order from you. And he said, if you would come and help me stock the store and help me arrange it on the shelves, he says, I'll buy groceries from you for as long as I'm in the grocery business. And his name was Leo Steer. And he said, yes, he says, I'll take care of it. And he says, you don't have to pay for it now. You can pay for it as you sell the merchandise. And he says, I'll come down and put it in. And that was our start in the grocery store. We worked as a family, all of us.
What was the store called?
You'll laugh. Jack Spratt.
Jack Spratt?
Jack Spratt. But he never had more than an eighth grade education, my dad, and always wanted to get educated. Well, during the war, World War I, they made him, my dad, stay on the farm and work where his brothers went into the service. As far as the service was concerned, that had to be because they had to furnish the food for the service people, and that's sure. How come they kept him on the farm, and that bothered him a lot.
Well, and I could tell because I could see your face, but I think everybody listening could tell too that when you told the story of his integrity, of refusing to poke the pencil in the bag and drain out 10 pounds of sugar, that that choice that he made is something that made a very strong impression on you.
Oh, it sure did. And we were successful. I could go on and on. He would go to the competitors and ask them what he should pay for strawberries, for instance, that the people would, strawberries and raspberries and stuff like that. And they would tell him, he said, well, if you don't know what to pay for it, he says, that's just tough. But my dad was tough. He'd come back to the store and he says, we're going to buy all the berries that we can buy, we're going to pay more than what they're selling them for. He did that, and the first thing that happened was that he got everybody coming to him with the berries, so the competitors, there was seven stores in that little town.
Wow.
Seven. And he controlled the whole market on strawberries. They wouldn't sell them to any of the other stores. And pretty soon those fellows were coming to him and asking him if they could buy some strawberries from him. I'm using that as one item. That's how we kept going. And as the war came on, before the war, he started expanding. We had a store in Lake Crystal and one in Dodge Center. Then the war come, and of course, they took the managers out of those stores because they had to go into service, and he had to sell those because he couldn't get gas. They wouldn't give him gas to go to the stores, so he had to sell them.
I'm interested in your experience in those years. I'm just imagining that outside of going to school, you spent a lot of time in Jack Sprat.
I sure did. I bagged potatoes, sugar. I candled eggs. We bought eggs and sold them because they traded eggs for groceries in those days. They didn't have the money, so they'd trade eggs and things like that. And so, I bagged potatoes, I bagged sugar, I bagged dates. I hated that. I remember that the first granulated soap was Magic Washer that came. People wouldn't buy it. They all used the old bar soap, Procter & Gamble, PG, and the other one was OK, bar soap, and they'd cut it up and put it in their laundry. And so that wouldn't sell. Then, of course, the Magic Washer didn't sell. It just sat on the shelf for a long time. There was no frozen foods at those times or anything. And my dad made sure that we knew the grocery business. He made us work in the dry groceries, as we called it, till we could cut a percentage. He showed us how to do that. We had to learn to cut meat, showed us how to do that so that we could always know when we had to hire butchers and help that we knew what we were talking about when we had explained to, like, in the meat department how to cut meat and so forth. Because a lot of times your butcher that you'd hire, he had his own ways and he would try to tell you what he was going to do, and we had our ways that we wanted the way it was to be cut and so forth. So those were things that he taught us. Thank heavens. So I went into the business, then I knew what I was doing.
You know, usually I would save questions like this to the end, but it seems kind of relevant here. I get the sense that those years for you, living through the Depression, watching how your parents handled it, being a part of an all-in family endeavor like this grocery store, I have a feeling that that kind of shaped your perspective on life a little bit. What do you think it taught you?
It taught me to be honest and respect that alone, and how to work, how to do more than what you're asked to do. And I'm sure that helped me in the service to get where I got.
I'm looking forward to hearing about that. And do I have this right, that even though you were going to school and working at the grocery store, you still found a way to play some football too?
I was allowed to play one sport. My folks told me that I could play, my dad especially, because he always wanted to be in the sports. He loved baseball and all sports. But he said, you can play one, but otherwise you'll have to help us in the store. So I chose football. My middle brother, Warren, I dearly love him, but he was always one step above Mom and Dad and the rest of us. He was always up and going for something. So he somehow talked my folks into being able to play basketball. So they let him do it for 1 year anyway. My older brother, he had a sickness when he was born.
So he couldn't play sports?
Oh, no. He only went to the eighth grade. But he still did real well. He was the one that did our grocery delivery and everything in the grocery store. And he cut meat. And in fact, he worked in my store as a butcher.
Huh. Well, and how good of a football player were you?
Probably not the best, but I thought I was, I guess. I was a running guard. I'd go out and run ahead of the ball carrier and supposedly knock out the fellow that was going to tackle him. That was my goal, I guess.
So if you're a running guard and you're paving the way for the ball carrier and you're knocking guys over, you must have had a nice big reinforced helmet with a face mask, right?
Yeah, sure did. Broken tooth. and just about drowned, and because we played in the rain or whatever, and was in a mud puddle and piled on me and with all everybody, but I happened to be on the bottom in the water, and like I said, I just about drowned.
These are the leather helmet days.
You bet they are.
Now, I've had a few people over the years, in fact, a few guys who even went on to play professional football in the 40s, who have said that they thought football was a safer sport with leather helmets than it is now.
Is that right?
What do you think?
Well, we thought that hard helmet was pretty nice. We only had the one, but I admit that it was padded where ours had the bands across, about that much space between the softness and the bands, so you had quite a bit of, you know, that you could stand quite a hit, and we all lived through it.
Well, you also lived through something that most of us listening right now didn't live through, but it's been my experience that anyone who did live through it has a memory of it. December 7th, 1941. I guess you were only 14 years old.
Right.
What do you remember about that day and how you found out?
I can remember sitting on the floor by the fireplace, listening to the radio and hearing what was being broadcast. It was hard to believe.
Had you ever heard of Pearl Harbor before?
No.
When did it start to become real? What were some of the things that followed that made you realize what was going on?
When they inducted my older brother, January 42.
So a month later, your older brother, who couldn't play sports in high school because of his physical condition,
right,
is getting drafted into the Army.
No, he didn't go to high school.
He finished in eighth grade, you said. Yeah. So that got your attention.
Absolutely. And when they marched through town, because they were inducting people almost weekly, there'd be a group that would go through town, get on a bus, and then go to Fort Snelling. That's where you were inducted, and that was very common. Everybody would line the street and wish them well, of course, I guess.
Was that hard for you?
Well, yeah, when it's your brother, it's one of them.
When your brother and all these other draftees are marching through town, is there any concern in your mind that he might not come home?
Probably not at my age at that time, not realizing really what a war was going to be like and what it is until probably, I'm going to say, even a year later. Then it starts hitting when they start talking about in our house.
When you start getting letters from Harry and hearing some of the places he's going?
Yeah, I wonder what you're going to do. You start thinking, and in school, especially on the football team, because that's where a lot of us conversed a lot about different things, because we were all about the same age and we were getting close to being drafted. We'd already, by that time, it was in high school, of course, and we'd already had our draft cards. We were already classified as 1A. The war was in full force. All of us, especially on the football team, were talking about, well, what are you going to do when you graduate? What branch are you going to go in? And so forth. And of course, I was listening in on it. And I was one of the younger ones, I admit. And, well, they didn't want the Army and didn't want the Marines. I said, what's left? Well, he said, just the Coast Guard and the Navy. And so happened to be five of us, kind of the tough players, bragging a little bit. And we decided that we were going to join the Navy, and this was in 44. The five of us said that we were going to go up and enlist. So that's what we did in December. We went up and enlisted. And at that time, as you may recall, the war in Europe was looking great, and they were closing in on Berlin. We were hoping that we could get into the Navy. My brother, middle brother, he didn't. He had to go to the Coast Guard. They weren't taking anybody in the Navy at his. That was 2 years before this.
Right.
So he didn't want the Marines or Army, so he picked the Coast Guard, and they did take him. And anyway, the five of us, they went through our physicals and all that, and passed everything and ready to be sworn in, and then an officer walked in and he said, we're going to send all these home so they have Christmas at home. He says, we'll take them after Christmas. And so that's what happened, and we were inducted into the Navy, and we were supposed to have 14 weeks training, and they cut it to 7 because they were getting closer to Berlin all the time, and things were looking up that we had to get to the Japanese in the Pacific, so they were pushing us in the Navy. And I, to this date, I swear that in our company of 128, that there wasn't one person other than the sergeant in charge that was over 25. Mm-hmm. We were all young. We were young and stupid. And we never even got a chance to get to what they call small stores. That's like a place where you could buy candy bars and ice cream and stuff. We never even got out of our barracks. We were always penalized for something. But we did. We pulled 7 weeks.
Where was that?
In Great Lakes.
Great Lakes, yeah. And before that, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, since you were only 17,
right.
You had to get your parents to sign for you too, right?
Absolutely. And the only reason that my parents would sign, as you remember, the Sullivan brothers, all five were gone on the one ship.
On the Juno.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. So I had a brother in Germany at the time, my older brother. And Warren, my next brother, the Coast Guard one, he was scheduled to leave to go overseas. So my mother wouldn't sign for me. My dad did because he knew he wanted to go to the service. And he knew that I would have, he could have my feelings. And so he signed, but mother wouldn't. And then we told her about the Sullivan brothers that were gone. And she remembered all of that, of course. But we said, now, if two are overseas, the third one doesn't have to go. So I said, and my dad, I can hear him yet, too. He says he won't have to leave the United States. And, of course, mother said, are you sure? And, yeah, we're sure. He says, since the Sullivan brothers, he won't have to leave. And so she reluctantly signed. So that's how I went in. And I was overseas in May.
And who knows what their conversation was at that point?
I sure don't know.
But since you mentioned your other brothers, I'm interested to know what they went through in the war as much as you know.
And oh.
I am noticing, too, that your oldest brother was Harry Bailey.
Harry Bailey, Jr.
We've all seen a movie where there's a World War II hero named Harry Bailey.
Oh.
It's a Wonderful Life. I wonder if he got those comments the rest of his life.
I don't know, but he drove supply trucks.
Uh-huh.
Is what his job was. And my middle brother was unloading, of all things, buttons in New York.
That was his Coast Guard job?
Yeah, and he was unloading buttons. And the buttons were 70-pound wooden boxes, and they were coming down a roller of the truck that he was unloading to put on a ship, I guess. And you know how fellows are. They was seeing how fast they could put the boxes on the roller going down, and he was catching them and stacking them. Well, he turned his back to stack, and one of those boxes hit him in the back and cracked two of the vertebrae.
Oh.
And that's what put him in the hospital. And then that's how come I had to go overseas. And my, like you said, I'm sure my mother was beside herself. She never showed it, though.
And I just want to understand the motivations. You mentioned being with your four football teammates. What do you think it was that said, this is the time we need to get in now? Where did the motivation come from?
Well, we were afraid we were going to be drafted. At the way things were going, mm-hmm. they were taking as fast as they could get help. Military people, they wanted everybody they could get.
Uh-huh.
And that's why they were pushing through the trainings and stuff so fast.
Did you guys think you were going to be able to stay together, the five of you?
We thought that when we went in, but that was a whole lot of something else. That's quite a story. Everything was alphabetically in line, from A, B, C, on down the lines. We lined up after we come back. We had to leave from boot camp. We were given 5 days. It took us 1 day to get home, 3 days at home, and 1 day to get back again. So we were only home 3 days. Like I said, everything was a hurry up, and we get back and all get it together, and they lined us up and had us all in alphabetical order in a line. There was 128 of us, and the first 10, they come over and crossed us off and said, the first 10, step over here. Well, there went everybody but the one other ball player with me, Don Billman. He and I always got along real well. And he said, you 10, or you're going to Treasure Island. Of course, neither one of us even knew what Treasure Island was. And so they put us on a train, and it was a cattle train. It was nothing but an empty thing with the bunks on the wall that folded down during the day, except the bottom one. That made us a place to sit, and the other ones folded down. And that's the way we came across to Treasure Island.
It's time for our first break, but we'll ride along on Wayne Bailey's World War II Navy adventure when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. If you're a business owner, I've got a phone number you really ought to take down, 800-989-1139. And when I say business owner, I mean businesses of all shapes and sizes. sizes, from the multinational chain to the hot dog stand on the corner, or my personal preference, the taco truck. 800-989-1139. Because you can have the greatest product or service in the world, the best business plan, the most capable workforce, and still not maximize your potential if you don't have a reliable, efficient, and versatile plan for processing payments. 800-989-1139. That's the number for my friends at Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in the country. Why is Provident growing so fast? Because they're committed to helping your business grow. 800-989-1139. That nonprofit you love that relies on donations? Provident can even connect you to a special software platform to streamline and stimulate giving. If you are ready to grow, give it a go. Go Provident today at providentpayments.com or call that number, 800-989-1139.
Proudly presented by Provident Payments. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit today with 94-year-old Wayne Bailey of Turlock, California, a Navy veteran of World War II. When we left off, the 17-year-old Minnesota native had been rushed through training and sent to Treasure Island in San Francisco.
They took us to the dock. Pretty soon they'd call off 8 or 9 names, and you go to that ship. The truck would go a little bit further, and they'd call off 4 or 5 names, and you go to that ship. It was real exciting. All of a sudden, I'm the only guy there on the truck. My heart was in my throat. They called my name and said, "This is your ship." And I'd never even seen a ship, naturally coming from the Midwest. And I thought that was the biggest thing I'd ever seen. They told me to go up the gangplank. Gangplank didn't mean anything to me. I didn't know what it was. And he says, "That's the ladder there. You go up the steps there." The ship is about 30 feet from the water level. So I load up this sea bag and all the gear and go up the, thank heavens I'd played football. Went up the gangplank and I get up to the guard up there and told him I was reporting for duty. He said, "You ever been here before?" And I said, "No, sir." And I wasn't even an officer. It was just an enlisted man. He says, "You go down and just come back up again, and you do it right." I didn't know what he meant even. So I go down all those steps again, turn around, lug all that stuff back up. He just read me up one side and down the other. I won't use the language. The last I remember is he says, "If you're ever going to be a sailor," he says, "you listen now." And he said, "There's a flag at the back of the ship." He says, "You're to salute that flag when you come up the steps, and then turn and salute me. Then you can enter." And that's what I did. And that was my first inauguration, getting on a ship. So that's what happened. I was a pretty lonely guy. So I reported, and they put me on the deck force. And after a few weeks of that, I knew that I was never going to be a deckhand. That wasn't cut for me.
And what kind of ship was it? What was the name of the ship?
USS Biloxi.
That's a light cruiser?
Light cruiser. Beautiful ship and crowded. 1,200 men on that ship. And the quarters were tight. And I could really tell you some stories, but of how they treat when they get a green guy on. I was doing the same after I was considered assault. But it wasn't much fun.
Can you give us a taste of that, of what they had to do to break you in there?
First thing that I had never been used to as an individual anywhere was the heads or the bathrooms. And it was just a long trough with boards. Maybe you've seen such, that was my first thing that I'd ever come in. You're sitting shoulder to shoulder, and the fellow where the water comes down and runs in the trough, he knows when there's a green fellow on. First thing he did, and you probably remember, rolled up toilet paper, lit it on match. Everybody else knew, but not me. And I can remember doing it myself. So he puts it on the water, and the water goes down. And, of course, you're sitting there, and you know what happens. And that was quite an inauguration of coming into the ship, I'll tell you.
Is that where the expression comes from? Light a fire under his tail?
I guess. That must be, I guess. because that sure happened there many times. And I made up my mind that I was not going to be a deckhand, and I would take the first chance I get. And you got to understand, I didn't finish high school. But they did tell us that if your marks were good enough, and of course you had to have a C better or better average to play sports. You couldn't play sports. And so our marks were okay. And they told us when we enlisted that they would give us a diploma, which they did. In fact, I got it after I came to California. That's when.
Several years later.
Yeah.
Well, and I'm glad you brought that up, because I assumed that, but we probably haven't made that clear to the audience, that when you five guys were on the football field saying, hey, let's go into the Navy, you knew you weren't going to be finishing high school.
Right. But after I got home, I had made close friends with a Jewish boy from New York. You got to remember, we're on a southern ship, and very few northerners on there, and we were treated pretty rough at times.
Like they call you names and stuff?
Oh, yes. Always. Once in a while, it'd be a scrap. But I knew I was not going to be happy in being a deckhand, because it was just a different, whole different group of individuals, just a rougher group, it's all. And it takes that type to do that type of work. And so the first chance I had was when we had a little paper that came out weekly. On it, it said that they were looking for a yeoman striker in what I read as the chaplain's office. I thought, boy, there's an opening. I'm going to go and see it. Because you have to wait for an opening. You just can't go up the ranks. You have to wait till there's an opening to do it. And I'm just a second-class seaman. So I take time, and I go to the chaplain's office, and I ask the chaplain, I said, I'm here to apply for your yeoman position. He said, no. He says, I'm not looking for any yeoman. I said, well, that was in the paper. No, he says, that's captain's yeoman. Oh, I said, well, I'm not interested in that, because I didn't think I could even come close with not even a high school education. So I said, no, I'm not interested. Then I said, well, he says, you're going with me. He says, I'm taking you up there. He says, you come here and applied. I'm sure your thoughts are that you want to be a yeoman. I said, well, I didn't care whether it's a yeoman or not. I said, I just don't care about the deck force.
Mm-hmm.
He says, I understand. That's all he said, is I understand. So he drags me up to this captain's office, and I had to get in line. There was probably six or eight. I can hear the fellow behind me. His name was Bodie. He said, Bailey, what are you doing here? I said, I didn't want to be here, but I said, they brought me up here. So I said, I've got a report here so I can tell them where I've been from the deck force. So he says, what's your education? I hadn't finished high school. Well, I'm a college graduate. He says, I don't know what you're doing here. And I said, well, I don't either. So I said, that makes us two alike. And we go in, and they interview each one. And when they come to me, I went in, and I was verbal interviewed for a little bit. And thank heavens I'd taken a business course, and I'd taken typing. They'd put me down to type, and they give you a form, and had a bunch of little squares and lines, and you were supposed to put certain words in the lines and X's in the squares and everything. Well, the first thing I did wrong was put the carbon paper in backwards. And because I'm nervous. And of course, I didn't hit hardly any squares. The lines went up and down a little bit, but I was pleased. I thought, well, I won't ever be called. So they let me go, and I went back to the deck force, and nothing happened. And went on for almost 2 weeks, I recall. I was working in the warehouse of the ship where we had stored all the canned goods and stuff. I was clear up at the top of them, and the bosun mate came in there, and he wasn't too happy, and he yelled at me, and he said, Bailey, he says, you got to report to the captain's office. And I thought, man, I wonder what now. And he got me down there and off the pile of stuff, and I went up there, and they told me I had the job if I was willing to take it. And I said I sure would, because I wasn't going to get off that deck force. And I couldn't believe that I got it. So, but I did, and that was where I went up the line. I got up to third-class yeoman and third-class petty officer. And I'd done the Dewey Decimal filing system in business, and so they had me do the filing of the restricted, confidential, and that type of everything but secret. I was in charge of the file, and it was locked, of course, and only opened when the captain wanted it. And that was it. And then from then on, I had to type and do all the clerical work that was done on the ship there in the office. Processed all the officers, anybody that was being transferred or anything. We handled all that. And like I said, there's no hero in me or anything.
And where did you guys go? So you left San Francisco. Where'd you go?
They announced it over the PA system. We got a big kick out of that. I think we were making $29 or $31 or some dollars a month. And when you cross the line into the fighting area, you get a 10% raise. So we laughed because you get $3 more to get shot at. That was what they all said all the time.
Yeah.
Every time you crossed that line, and you did, you got 10% more. But as soon as you come back to the States to load ammunition and food, you lost the 10% right away too. So they didn't overdo it. The first thing that we did was just to practice on the guns was on the island of Guam. We had a captain that was... He was a great man, don't misunderstand me, but he would go in against the rough areas, and he wanted to practice, or he wanted to check all the guns again. So he says, we're going to wait until the Japanese go. He says, we know where there's a dining room. We're going to wait till they all go there. And he announced this over the PA system, and that's what we did. We blew up the dining hall, and that was my first thought of killing somebody.
Mm.
And from there, then we went over in the Philippines and Okinawa and South China Sea, Guadalcanal area and all that type of stuff, and unloaded onto the beaches. But Wake Island was a tough one. We went in against 8-inch guns, and we only had 6-inch on the ship, and the captain wanted to know if we'd give him the authority to go in under the range of the 8-inch guns and take out emplacements. Now, I'm sure you're familiar with the cruiser. It carries 3 planes, pontoon planes.
Mm-hmm.
So our planes would go up and look for the encasements and whatnot of the big guns, and they would set down approximate the distance and so forth. And then the one setting sights on the big guns, that's what we would use. And you got to remember, we're in range. We had to get in with a 6-inch gun, and there with an 8-inch. And we did. We took one underneath the ship. And it really, I thought that was it.
And where were you, what was your duty station when General Quarters sounded?
Of all places, powder room.
Ooh.
You're at the very bottom of the ship, and they always dog you down because it's better to lose 6 men than to lose half of 1,200.
I know what you mean when you say dog you down, but explain for people who aren't familiar with that terminology. When they dog you down, you're not getting out of there.
No, you lock the doors. They lock the doors and shut off the air. There's air circulation, but nothing, there's no fans or anything going, and it's hot.
They want to contain the damage if something goes wrong.
Right, so it doesn't go through the ventilation system.
Which for you means you know it's all or nothing.
Right, and it's hot, and we're stripped down to our shorts.
And you're, by this time, 18 years old.
Yeah, just 18.
And so what did you have to do in the powder room?
In the powder room, we're down where the casings are. We're at the very bottom of the ship. They're in the casing, and we called it the lift, or it's an elevator type thing. And you've got to keep them going. They're in a case, in a casing. You have to take, the one man takes the casing off, tips it towards you if you're by the lift, and you catch it in your arm like this, and you turn and lay it onto the lift. And you've got to do it so fast, depending on what the turret is doing. In our case, on Wake Island, it was all emplacements that they were trying to soften for the Marines, the beach. So we weren't using any shrapnel type, because in the turret up above, they have projectiles that are set with timers, and they're like you would, if you're having an air attack, and there's a lot of them up there, fighters, a lot of times we used the big guns and would blow them up into the air, and then the timer would explode it up there, and the shrapnel would damage the planes and whatnot. It'd take in a bigger area. You're probably familiar with that all.
Sure.
So, but here it was just the emplacements and whatnot. One of their projectiles went off underneath our ship, and it raised it right up out of the water. And we thought we were hit good, but...
Because you're, as you said, at the bottom of the ship,
yeah,
so you felt that more than most.
Oh, and it raised the ship even. It was unbelievable.
But you know, if that was a hit, and if the ship goes down, you're not getting out.
No. You know that every time you go in, so...
How do you prepare yourself for that?
The first time or two, you don't. afterwards you take communion and hope for the best. And I was lucky, that's all.
That sounds pretty tiring, too, when you're passing shell after shell after shell in those hot conditions.
We were there, it was under 3 days, and they'd bring our sandwich to us, and usually a pickle or a slice of lemon in case you seasick or something. And you had nothing but a bucket to use for a toilet, because you're in there to stay.
It's break time again. We're getting a little taste of what Wayne Bailey experienced as a teenage sailor in World War II, but there's much more to come, including kamikazes, typhoons, prisoners of war, and the aftermath of an atomic bomb. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328. When life throws you curveballs, you have to be adaptable, or at least have a good pinch hitter on the bench who knows how to handle a curve. When it comes to your business, Provident Payments is the best teammate you could ever have. Perhaps it helps that many of the leaders for one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America are former ballplayers. Contactless payments, online ordering, point of sale, you name it, Provident Payments knows it. Now, you could get some of these services from one of the big banking companies, but you're never going to get the kind of personalized service that Provident Payments delivers every day. 24/7 solution-based tech support. When your ability to process payments goes haywire in any way, time is money. So would you rather wait on hold for who knows how long, or would you like to have a direct line you can call for immediate help? That's where a good teammate comes in. Learn more about bringing Provident Payments onto your team at providentpayments.com. They really are one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. That website again, providentpayments.com.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, visiting this week with Wayne Bailey of Turlock, California. Originally from Minnesota, he served on the light cruiser USS Biloxi during World War II. Did you ever get seasick?
First time. You know where they had me posted? We were right out of San Francisco, naturally, and you know how rough it is right there by the Golden Gate Bridge. Yeah. I'm setting sights on these 6-inch guns. There's four dials. Three of them raise and lower the guns this way, and the fourth one turns you around. And the gunner's mate calls these numbers off to you, and you set these dials just as fast as he calls them. Well, I was so seasick, they could have shot me, and I'd have been happy. I couldn't see the dials or nothing. I was so sick that first day, and I wasn't the only one. I mean, there was even some of the old salts, because that's rough water out there, really rough. But after that, when I went out again, I got woozy, of course, but not that sick, and then pretty soon you're okay. I mean, I was anyway.
And you mentioned the old salts. Obviously, there were guys who had been on that ship a lot longer than you when you came aboard. Did they tell you all some of the stories of what they'd already been through in the war and some of their close calls?
Well, especially the kamikaze plane that come in. Because when you'd hear them, the planes, The ones on the 40s and the 20s were the main ones that would intercept those types of the 5 and 6 inch guns. I mean, they're no fight for the planes. And you'd hear them yell, DP, DP. I mean, death plane. And you'd know that that particular plane, and you'd hear it. It has a different sound.
So, and you're saying that as if you experienced that.
Well, yeah. You once in a while, they'd be one show up. Yeah, in the South China Sea, I remember them coming in. You knew that if they weren't strafing, you knew they had to be carrying a bomb, and you can hear it. And when I was taken off the powder room and I was put into the turret, the 6-inch guns. And that's how I knew that you had to set timers and stuff. And that was to shoot them up in the air, and the shrapnel would go out on the plane and damage them to some sort.
But when you're in these situations where you hear DP, DP, death plane, kamikaze, the context of that is these guys who've been on the ship told you about the time a kamikaze actually struck your ship.
Oh, yes.
It might have done a lot of damage, but the bomb didn't go off? Is that right?
No, didn't detonate.
So you're aware of what can happen if one of those planes strikes?
Absolutely. And they said it weighed 1,200 pounds. We mounted it on the side of the ship.
I see that here.
Oh, yeah. Or they mounted it.
So it was still there when you got on the ship?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. It was there when we put it in mothballs.
So when you came aboard the ship, you saw a Japanese bomb mounted on the ship.
Yeah, I didn't realize what it was until I was told. I mean, I just thought it was imitation, you know, some decoration type, just for some reason. I had no idea. And then they told me, especially when I got into the office, I got a lot of information.
What did they tell you about it?
Oh, it was just unbelievable. The ones on the 40s, as they told me, knew the pilot was dead. He was slumped when he come in, because they'd just about riddled his plane with the 20s. Evidently none of the 40s hit it or anything. It came in, and that's the damage that it did. It entered the in where the planes were, and there's 2 500 barrel plane fuel attached to the bulkhead. It creased those. When they told me about it, I went back and looked, and sure enough, they were still creased. It creased it and bulged the top a little bit.
So if that had been a little bit different, there wouldn't have been much ship left for you to get onto.
Well, there sure wouldn't, because that would have taken the whole works.
And you mentioned Wake Island.
Oh, yeah.
So this is, you know, Wake Island was taken the very first few days of the war, has been in Japanese hands since then, and your ship had a hand in taking it back.
Yeah, we sure did.
Is that something that was significant for you?
Yeah, it was for me, because I'd never had to go that long. It was a good 2 days.
You don't know this, but we're getting closer and closer to the end of the war at that point.
Absolutely.
I believe that was right before they dropped the bomb, right?
Yep. And we were all, the 7th and 6th Fleet were up in Okinawa. And boy, you saw a bunch of ships. That was it. We were so crowded that they had to stand watch so the ships wouldn't bump each other. And that's when my friend Don Billman called me from his ship in Buckner Bay, Okinawa. Next thing I got was a call for go to the radio shack, and there was a message. And I went there, and here was Don Billman had found out that I was on the Biloxi and contacted me. And that was the first time we'd ever encountered each other since we split up on Treasure Island. Anyway, so much for that. And then, like I said, all these ships were in there in this Buckner Bay. And then we got the report that a typhoon was headed for Buckner Bay. We were told that we had to get out of there because it was going to hit Buckner Bay. So everybody, all the ships started getting out. The wind changed, and we run right into the thing, the typhoon. And it just pounded. That was the worst part of my whole experience, I think, was the typhoon. You just can't believe the waves and stuff that it did. Naturally, everything is dogged down, everything. So if the ship went upside down, it would float.
So where were you on the ship as you're enduring that situation?
You aren't allowed out on the deck,
right,
at all on the typhoon. It's completely dogged down. Even then, we lost 2 men, and that was ridiculous. Back again to the deck force, the bosun mate reprimanded 2 sailors that had done something. I don't know what they'd done, because I helped write up the summary court-martial of it. But he sent them topside to empty a garbage can.
During a typhoon?
During a typhoon.
and got him killed.
Nobody was to be up there. Nobody. He sent him up there, and naturally it caught the can and went over. Two sailors lost him, and the light cruiser and above can't stop and pick up anyone. Are not supposed to, they say. And there was no way they could live in that water anyway, so that's what happened.
And where were you on the ship while you were going through the typhoon, and can you help us understand what that felt like, what that experience was like? In my mind, it seems like it would feel pretty helpless.
You are helpless. You can't do anything. Everything is bolted down. For instance, in our office, the typewriters and all that stuff is bolted down. The help is absolutely doing only what has to be done, because the cooks can't cook. All you're getting is a sandwich, always a sandwich, a pickle, and a slice of lemon. And we do absolutely nothing. Other than that, no, there was more head injuries, more broken arms, more broken legs during the typhoon than any other injuries on the ship.
So were you holding on to something?
Oh, yeah. You don't walk any further than you have to, because when you got to go through the hatch, you got to bend over and you whack your head, or you go to step and the ship tips and there's no step there then.
Were you frightened at all by that?
Frightened? Oh, even the portholes were dug down because they could break. The
sure.
Glass could break. Well, in the office again, we had a porthole. We looked out at the water. That's how we'd know how high the waves were and whatnot. We'd hang on to different things there in the office and look out through the porthole there. And just unbelievable. And that ship would just pound when it'd go up and then come down. And broke the bow, cracked it. All small stores got wet.
When was that typhoon?
Before the atomic bomb. Because we thought we were there for the invasion of Japan. That was our talk, everything that we heard.
Sure.
We were ready to invade Japan. We used to enjoy Tokyo Rose every night. Where she got all that music that was the latest stuff there was, and no one could ever tell.
Did she ever mention your ship by name?
I don't recall ever. She just picked on the personnel.
So how did you receive that? Why'd you keep listening?
It made you wonder.
Yeah?
It does, because I was gone a year and a half. I never did get home. My wife and I were real close in school and everything. And you listened to Tokyo Rose, and she would tell you stories about everything that was going on at home. And even the married guys, they'd pick on their wives.
So she made you wonder if you might get a Dear John letter, or your girlfriend found another guy?
Yep. It sure did. It made you wonder when you're gone a year and a half. A lot of things happen in that length of time, but nothing did in my case.
So was Betty writing you letters during the war?
Oh, yeah. We had a code fixed up.
You guys were already a couple?
Well, yeah, we high school. Like I said, I had to work a lot, and she'd come in and stand by the meat counter, and she and I'd visit on Saturday nights. One day, my dad went over to her, and he says, if you're going to come in here and talk to my son, he says, you might as well put an apron on and go to work. And you'd have to know my wife. She said, all right, where's the apron? And he went and got it, and she went to work, and she went to work for him.
So she was writing you letters while you're on the ship, and you said you devised a code. What can you tell me about that?
I would start the paragraph with the island or wherever the ship had entered or had fracas with. Like, the worst one was the Philippines. I had a heck of a time writing that letter to start paragraphs with each one of the syllables of the Philippines.
So the first paragraph was P and then H and I?
Yeah.
Yeah, it is a lot of paragraphs.
I didn't want to put them all on the front one page, so I'd write page after page.
Did they actually make it through to her without getting censored?
Yeah, and they might have been more lax at that time, too.
Later on in the war. Yeah.
But we thought we were pulling a good one anyway, so.
You mentioned the atomic bomb.
Yes.
And contact with your old high school buddy, Billman.
Yes.
Did all five of you guys who went in together, did you all make it home?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Yes, they all did.
Good.
Not under the best conditions. One was an alcoholic, and Billman, he was kind of like me. He lost his hearing real bad. The guns were, in those days, were real loud, and the strafing of the ship and stuff, it's hard on the ears.
Sure.
They just ring afterwards, you know.
So you've had trouble with your ears for 75 plus years, and also with your feet, I understand, because you got caught taking a shower at the wrong time.
Because you take a shower with that many men, you take a shower whenever you can take it. There was probably 8 or 10 of us in the shower. You get submarine attack, they say. You hear the battle stations, and you know what you're supposed to do, and because each one is different than the other. I mean, you know whether it's an air attack, you know whether it's a ship, you know whether it's a submarine, or the different tones and so forth of the alert. So we knew we had to get topside. So if you're blowing, your chances are better because you'd be blowing off than if you're inside. You know that.
I mean, sure.
And so we're in the shower, and the first thing we hear is this battle station, and we just take off. I mean, it's all men on the ship, so it don't make any difference whether you're dressed or not. And we take off and run up topside. Well, of course, it's hotter than Billy Heck on that metal. And of course, we're on the metal and not on wood. Like, there is a wood deck too, but we aren't close to that. And it's crowded up there, and some of them are laying down. A lot of times you're told to lay down or whatnot, but long as you're topside. So I didn't want to lay down in that heat, so I was standing. I burnt the bottoms of my feet on the metal, because I don't know how long now. We were there a long time, it seemed. And so I went to sick bay, and I went in with my feet, and I told him I burned them. And yeah, he said, you have. You burned them good. So he put some salve and stuff on them, and from now on, he says, you wear nothing but white socks. That's just what he told me to do. To this day, other than when I dress and so forth, I wear white socks when I worked. And my feet have, of course, they were burned, so they never sweat or do any of that stuff at all. They just stay dry all the time. And they work fine. I mean, I'm fine.
And so your ship went to evacuate some of those prisoners of
that's
war.
That's right. We went right into the dock in Nagasaki. It was the first stop.
And some of these guys have been prisoners for more than 3 years.
Oh, one of them especially, that I got to know. It wasn't a long trip between Nagasaki and Okinawa. Okay. They got the men from the prison where they were, got them on the ship, and you got to remember, there's 1,200 of us on the ship, and so where are you going to put hundreds of prisoners? Well, we used the hot bunk system. They slept at daytime, we slept at night in the same bunk. I'd get out of the bunk, he would get the man that was there in my bunk would get in, and that's where he would sleep. The one that was in my bunk was from what they call the Dutch East Indies Island, you know, the Dutch islands that they had. He was a Dutchman, so still American. I'll never forget him as long as I live. He was an older man. At least he looked older. I shouldn't say he was older, because they all looked old. But he, in turn, finally, as we conversed, he showed me his hands, and I'm sorry.
Take your time.
All of his fingers were burnt with a cigarette. His fingernails. Both hands. For stealing a handful of rice, because he was hungry. I'm sorry.
Oh.
And I thought I was a complainer because I didn't like the way the meat was cooked or something when it would come time to eat. And here was a man, damaged for life. And then the other individual that I met is really a story. He was from Texas, and he went in at the same age that I did, and he was captured in 1942. The ship went down, and he was picked up and captured, and he was just a young kid, and like I said, he was from Texas. His hair was snow white, and I went out on the deck. It was at night, and I went up on the deck, and naturally I noticed, like others did, his white hair. It was just as white as snow, really. So I went over to him, and because I saw him riding. I says, what are you riding? Riding home? No. He said, I'm not. I'm just figuring up how much money I got coming. He was using the $22 pay that he was getting when he went in. He was trying to figure out how much he was going to have coming when he could get paid. I'll never forget that. Long as I live. And he and I then conversed, because he was from Texas, so I would see him quite often, and naturally he was easy to find with that white hair. You'd know where he was, and he and I became close friends for just a day or two to get to Okinawa and get him in a hospital. And
did getting to know those two and seeing that whole collection of prisoners in the physical shape that they were in, did that give you some more perspective on the importance of what you and your shipmates were doing?
Oh, it did me, that's for sure, because they told me they worked in the coal mines. They'd work there until they were just wore out, and then they were given, we'd kind of call it the ship Liberty, where they would be easier, and their work then was using a hammer, busting up rock, making a street or a road. That was what they got for coming out of the coal mine, and then as they cleaned their lungs and stuff, I suppose, a little or something, then they'd put them back in the coal mine, he said again, and the conditions.
You know, you mentioned there that where you picked all of those ex-POWs up was Nagasaki.
And Hiroshima.
There's a reason that the names of those cities are so familiar to people all these years later. What did you get to see?
Oh, devastation, unbelievable.
They took you all in there?
They didn't take you in. You had to sneak in. They didn't know what the radiation and stuff.
What made you want to go in and inspect some of the damage?
Curiosity, I suppose. An atomic bomb, I never heard of it. I had no idea what it was, even. You couldn't believe that one bomb would do what was done.
Well, you've been very generous with your time, and if there's anything else that's important for you to mention, feel free. I don't want to forget to say thank you. Thank you for serving our country, and thank you for telling us this story. As you look back over your life, is there something you'd say you're most proud of or that you're most thankful for?
I would say my wife. She went with me in every business deal. She never looked back. Anything that I did, she was there 100%. She never looked back, always looked ahead.
Here's one more question for you. I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. If I picture you, you know, on the ship, when you're down in the powder room and one of those 8-inch shells from Wake Island goes off underneath your ship, or when you're on a gun crew and they're talking about kamikazes coming in, or when you're holding on for dear life in the typhoon, was there something that helped you, that you think helped you endure those moments that might get the best of some of the rest of us?
My Christian faith. God kept me healthy all the way.
I don't want to put words in your mouth. Are you saying that in some of those moments on the ship, you were talking to God a little bit?
You better believe it. Not only me, but the ones beside me.
Once again this week, the time went by way more quickly than we'd like. We're out of time on the radio, but we do have a few more of Mr. Bailey's World War II memories included in the podcast version of this episode, available at hometownheroesradio.com. Thanks so much for listening today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.